with a deeper commitment to being willing to talk to them, that we're able to have a resilient relationship as a byproduct. Now, that said, you don't have to look very far, and Muslims and Jews find their differences really fast, right? So while we know our differences, and we're very well aware of them, I think of multiple examples, but one in particular happened in 2017, where the New York Post reported that in Queens, a woman and her daughter were attacked on a subway by a man who was shouting, "Get out of my country, you dirty Muslims," and they were Orthodox Jews. And so, you know, the rest of the world might, like, we're aware of our differences, but the rest of the world might doesn't always see them. And so whether we like it, our fates are intertwined sometimes. And by diving into those connections, we can reach points where people are willing to be there for each other. And I think of another example where a young man, 17-year-old Ahmed Khalifa, saw another woman being attacked on a Brooklyn subway. And he literally shouted and intervened and then ran after the guy to make sure that justice was served. And so he's a young, Muslim young man, and she was a Jewish woman. And so, and when you asked him, like, why he did it, it was kindness. It was just kindness. And that there is something to be said for what does it mean for us to create the conditions by which connection is possible, and where we can, and where we're modeling kindness, and we're willing to take that leap of faith into what it means to be able to hold on to that, especially when we're feeling scared, and especially when we're feeling like we're not accepted and we don't belong.
So I want to, fabulous comments, I want to make sure that we get different people into the conversation. I'll start with this gentleman here and then Climb, and then I saw your hand here.
I'd like to raise the question of BDS on the campus here and the movement in the University of California to allow BDS demonstrations for you, those of you who don't know what that is. That's Muslim and Jew yelling at each other about what you're entitled to and what you're not entitled to. And if you could please address that, I would appreciate both of you.
Well, you go since you know UCLA.
Sure, thank you. So BDS, Boycott, Divestment, Sanction Movement, founded in the West Bank in Ramallah in 2005. The movement has three tenets. It advocates for an end to the Israeli occupation. It calls for equal rights for Palestinian Israelis, and it seeks a resolution of the Palestinian refugee problem according to United Nations Resolution 194. It proposes a menu of measures of pressure, including boycott, divestment, sanction, on Israel. And it has been a particular source of controversy on college campuses in America, including in the United States, including at UCLA. Just several weeks ago, we had a conference held by the National Parent Organization of Students for Justice in Palestine that generated a great deal of controversy. About whether it should be allowed to hold its conference on campus or not. With that basic description, I'll now tell you what I think. I think there are likely some people who are motivated by anti-Semitism who support boycott, divestment, and sanctions. My general sense of the movement is it's not an anti-Semitic movement. It is a movement that is sharply critical of Israel and seeks to apply pressure on it in, it's important to add, nonviolent ways. I myself am not a supporter of the BDS movement, so I speak with some measure of critical distance toward it. But I understand that it can be very discomfiting, especially for strong supporters of Israel, to hear the kind of
for young Jews who are
presumably not only Jews, but particularly Jews, for sure. That can be very discomfiting. I completely understand that. To hear the kinds of critiques uttered, maybe coupled with the sentiment that Israel as a Jewish state should not exist. These are difficult claims, to be sure, in the ears of those who are very committed to Israel's existence as a Jewish state. I understand that very well. I guess what I end up thinking is two things. One, Some claims of BDS discomfit me as well. But if this isn't the place for the articulation of views, many of which discomfit us, I mean the university, Jerry made the very important first point, university matters. I don't know where we can have a discussion over ideas that are very different in a meaningful, intensive, respectful way. We aren't always perfect in doing this, but I think it's a goal toward which we towards which we should aspire. So I think we have to allow for that kind of open discussion of discomfitting ideas on campus. That's my general view, within limits. I mean, I think there, I'm not going to advocate for an open conversation over the virtues of Nazism, but I differentiate very sharply Nazism from BDS, and I differentiate very sharply BDS and its discomfitting effects, which I think is an important conversation to have.
That's the problem.
And the murder of 11 Jews in a synagogue in Pittsburgh. I think we're here to talk about anti-Semitism, and the anti-Semitism that has had murderous consequences is that which was perpetrated in Pittsburgh. And I think we're, in a certain sense, deflecting the attention from the real obvious target if we focus in this setting, our attention on BDS and not on what was in Pittsburgh and what animated Robert Powers. That's a conversation I'm perfectly prepared to have, and it's certainly legitimate to raise it, but I'm just telling you what concerns me when I talk about and think about the legacy of anti-Semitism and its very live manifestations today.
Just to add to that, just because you had appointed me to, I think that it's a critical piece of multiple conversations that is important for Muslims and Jews to be having. And so the way we set it up at Newground, like the program that I described to you before, we go through from learning about and having educators come in on Islam, on Judaism, on Islamophobia, on anti-Semitism, on so many other subjects first, and then 60% of the way through the program, then we dive into, after we've continued to build muscles around having open, complete disagreement on a number of issues separate from Israel-Palestine, then we dive into it. And it is hard, and it takes a lot of effort, and it takes a lot of facilitators pulling people back in and saying, okay, what can we ask? What is it that we need to be creating here to create a space that will allow for the open dialogue, but also just for people to see heart-to-heart, like, how people get hurt. And the pain that is underneath the anger, and to be able to be willing to take those apart, those pieces, because it's when we are all stuck in a facade of like strong, strength that where we don't get anywhere, and that it's important to go there.
Thank you.
Yeah, I want to make a comment and then maybe ask a question. The comment is that I'm not sure, and I wonder what you think, that it's correct to speak about, or it's efficacious to speak about a linked fate. That implies that we all sort of share the common fate of being hated as others. And I haven't found anything constructive in common in linking groups because they're oppressed. I think, on the contrary, that it breeds a very unhealthy sense of self. And that if we're going to transform our society, we need to get back to talking about what it means to have a common destiny. I don't think we know that any longer. And we haven't worked on that at all. And if hatred is the thing that, the fact that people are hated, they're going to hate us all the time. It's not something helpful to me. Where am I going? Why is my going linked to someone else? How do we build this together? Who's leading us in that?
Good point. We will talk about it, but I want to hear the second part as well.
The second part is that, Josh got me to think about the following, because he ended by saying, basically, we're in trouble here because there are Jews who support Trump, and there are Jews who are not uncomfortable with white nationalists, right? That's what you said,
well,
except you didn't say it out loud like that. But you should have said that.
Certainly poetic.
Or romantic.
There.
Right? So, it's not that I want to focus on Jews. I want to say that we are very divided. And I also want to sort of kick that back to the campus. I was having a discussion with David this morning, and I realized that here on campus, you know, there may be a sentiment among some students that not that Jews will not replace us, but that Jews have to be replaced, and that there is a perception that Jews are too dominant, mm-hmm. and that's another thing that we don't talk about, mm-hmm. in terms of what the source of the of what we call anti-Semitism, and that Israel is not the issue at all. It's a resentment, and Israel represents a sense of success, a sovereignty for a group that was downtrodden, and we're still fighting for recognition, and the Jews have made it all the way.
So those are great points, and I just want to make sure that, you know, we get a chance to comment on them. And the first part about, again, linked faiths, whether the linkage is based on a story of either victimization, oppression, or being the object of hatred, or whether the linkage is actually more forward-looking positive, those are choices, and those are actually brute facts on which particular attributes are appealed to. I think there's a robust story to be said that if you constantly focus only on the downside of things, maybe that's not successful. Maybe that has collateral consequences that are not actually adaptive to succeed. That said, sharing and suffering, right? Maybe not the option of hate, but suffering is a way that people understand each other in all kinds of ways within particular groups, right? I'm obviously talking to one such group that understands what it means to share the stories of suffering, but also to recognize that, again, when I talk to, I'm an immigrant. I came over when I was 6 and a half. I'm first generation, right? Like, my parents were not here to get their second PhDs, right? We were just scrambling to make it. But I grew up in Skokie, right? So that's interesting in different kinds of ways, right? But the thing that I want to share, I digress. But the point is, given what Koreans had experienced back in the Korean War, how they were treated by their East Asian partners, the plight and the discrimination that we face, not knowing what the deal was, to try to translate that understanding for my parents to why they shouldn't say bad things about African Americans or Latinos or whatever they would do, that took so much work, and I could not get the common suffering of what it meant to be treated differently and worse, and to be presumed to be other. I could not get the common suffering to actually light that light bulb in my parents' head. And I own it. I love them dearly, but we come from different contexts. So again, whether we show linked faiths forward-looking problem-solving, I love that, right? That's what I have to do as an administrator. And if there's a strategy about doing that, that's what I'm here more of. The last part is just this part about envy, like the conflict here. Maybe it's not about Israel. If Israel instantiates and represents, again, success, of course, there's always envy. But, you know, most groups are viewed, again, this is social psychologist Susan Fiske created something called the stereotype content model early on. She was important in employment discrimination. And she said most groups could be put into a 2x2. You're either viewed as competent or not competent, or affable or not affable, right? And what oftentimes Jews, East Asians, businesswomen are viewed as, they're viewed as competent, not affable, right? Mm-hmm. That's exactly where we're put in. So you and I are put into similar pieces, and when you're competent and not affable, then they don't want to have a beer with you, they don't trust you, and when you win, there's envy. Mm-hmm. So they're targets of envy, right? And that's why everything can be upturned in a moment with glass shattering. That's the history of people who are the object of envy. And I think we ought to own that in different kinds of ways, that envy exists, right? Think about, and we should, in each of our groups, we should own that in different kinds of ways. Now, but with this kind of analysis, what more can we, I'm really interested in the possibility that we could have honest conversations about how people feel, how we can actually move forward, and I realize I'm a moderator, I should not be so loud.
I'll just jump in.
Yes.
So in terms of your points, both of your points, to connect them together, so stories of suffering are really critical to mobilize people and to get people to hear and feel. And the vision, right? Like what you're talking about, the sense of loss of dreaming. Like, those are really important things to be, that we need to be marrying to each other. And, like, the way that has really spoken and hit me in the face, I was driving on the 110 in the opposite direction. And my four-year-old from the back is just really upset. He's like, Mommy, like, I'm really upset about, he learned about Pharaoh at his Muslim day school. And he wanted to go back to ancient Egypt to teach Pharaoh a lesson. did a double take, and was like, honey, I think, you know, that was taken care of. And I didn't realize how completely off I was until later that night when he picked up his favorite book and handed it to me, which is about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And in this book, which is all about her persisting, we're flipping through the book, and it talks about her being a girl and having all the obstacles against her. And then it talks about her going on vacation when she's just about the age of my son's. And she sees a sign that says, no Jews, no dogs, no blacks, no colored, no Mexicans. And both my boys just are always exasperated, but especially this night, were really exasperated when they saw this and they heard the story. And then eventually, like, they're rooting for her by the end of this book because she becomes the Supreme Court Justice, right? And so it's this thing that, like, both her suffering and them being able to see her in their shoes, or like as Muslim kids growing up and not always feeling like they belong or that they're accepted, and then being able to see that there is a possibility, there's something we can dream towards. And I think those stories in our different communities can actually serve to both mobilize the suffering into this realm of dreaming.
So, I think, you know, it's fair to say that a linked faith that rests only in a shared sense of victimization is unhealthy. But I think, actually, your first statement is empirically wrong, that it's never been the case that groups have been linked together by tragedy. I think Jewish history is a classic example in which that particular group has very often found partners based on the shared experience of fate. We know of the case of African Americans. Many peoples in Eastern Europe in eras of revolution. In today's world, the Kurds, a people that is perceives itself to be the subject of very intense victimization, identifies intensely with Jews and, as it turns out, the State of Israel. I think the operative point is to not transform that shared sense of fate on the basis of victimization into something more constructive. That's where the danger lies. But, you know, just thinking back, you know the book well, Walzer's Exodus and Revolution makes, you know, very clear how that shared experience of oppression, right, echoing back on the ancient Israelite story of Yitzhak Mitzrayim, of Exodus from Egypt, has been an enormously power-catalyzing force, not just for remembering the suffering of the Israelites, but the mandate to seek a better world, the revolutionary...
That's what I was talking about, the constructive...
Yeah. Right, but it emanates...
The constructive memory, that's the point.
It's exactly. Empirically, it's just not correct to say that, you know, suffering has not been a source of stitching together. It has been, but I think the point you've just articulated is really the important one. Transforming from the experience of oppression to that revolution impulse to improve.
I don't ever think it's just a story of victimization. It's not a story of victimization. It's a story of resilience and resistance. And that's the sort of joint fate that people have. And, you know, I always tell my students, for example, the promise that we have in this particular country is that things can change. Things change for the better. Sometimes they change for the worse. But things, you know, tend to move in a more positive rate. And we're talking about the last 2 years, and so we're all, you know, under a cloud. But nonetheless, you know, overall, we do progress. We move forward. I tell my students, for example, that in 1830, in 1831, for example, when the American Anti-Slavery Society was formed, no one thought slavery was going to end in the United States in 35 years. No one would have thought that. You go from 2 million slaves in 1830 to 4 million slaves in 1860. It's the richest slave empire in the world. and cotton is king, and it's picked by slaves, and slavery is just not going to end in the United States, okay? So you have this collective of people who share a fit, which they share this notion that, you know, this country was built around freedom and not around slavery. They share this notion that, you know, there should be equality and all these other kinds of things that we like to talk about with regard to American ideologies and mythologies, and it ends. Now, it didn't end, and it didn't end beautifully. You know, 800,000 people died in the Civil War, and it didn't end perfectly. You know, but we had all these people coming together who were, you know, Protestant and Catholic and Jewish and Black and free and slave, and it ended. And so that's when I talk about, when I speak about, you know, people having common, being commonly repressed or oppressed, that's the beginning of the story. The middle of the story is always the resistance, you know, and the fact of the matter is that the people who hate in this country are really not the majority. They're not. So that the majority of the people in this country really do see a commonality in humanity. And that's what we really all have to tap into. And so, very respectfully, I disagree with you. Right. Nice to see you, though.
I thought you had your hand up, so I said yes here, and then I think the woman in the center, yes. So let's start here.
Yeah, just shifting just for a moment away from linked faith to the linkages of hate and why these forms, racism, anti-Semitism, and I think, Josh, you're bringing up the phallic images and showcasing like the homosocial toxic masculinity, which is kind of undergirding or just in existing in relation to anti-Semitism, at least in those images. And for instance, Linda Gordon's book on the second coming of the Ku Klux Klan shows that the Klan was also a kind of fraternity for the participants, and there was a similar kind of homosocial nature to those groups too. And just thinking too about the oldest hate, some people would say sexism predates anti-Semitism, but that's not my claim. I just think it's interesting that these hates exist very closely to one another, and I want to know how the panel thinks about the nature of those linkages. Does one power another, or do they exist in a kind of network of hate? And I think that would suggest that the problem is so intractable as history has proven it to be. But, you know, what are we dealing with? And especially we see these things concentrating among white nationalists today.
Yeah, great. Great ideas. Anyone wants to talk about
Groups? Just say real quick. I mean, first of all, thank you. That was very, really well put. I would add to your reading list the Klaus Thewlitz's book, Male Fantasies, Volume 1 and 2. It's two volumes. They're both very long.
Only two?
They're about 800 pages each. So. But I don't know, it's actually, these are not funny books. I don't know if you've read them, but they're accounts of the rise of the Third Reich and of Nazism as fear of the feminine. And so it equates this kind of recurring trope of the feminized Jew as representing a kind of spillage. There's all this Nazi worry about fluids and liquids and blood, menstrual blood. And about the effeminate male, the sissy. So there's a long, long history, as I'm sure many in this room know, of anti-Semitism that takes the form of a kind of explicit chauvinism and misogyny against women, but also against men who are not masculine enough. So one, perhaps too easy of an answer to your important question is that we are talking about power. We're talking about the loss of patriarchal power and the fear and the terror of what happens when patriarchy no longer can function as the center, when the center does not hold, right? And I think that's a lot of what we keep hearing tonight and that we hear all over the place is this, that there is this scramble of the last gasp, what one hopes is the last gasp, and it's also why things are not gonna get better before they get worse, I do believe. I still think that there's some there's many fights. There are many more fights to come.
Other reactions on just this articulation of, again, toxic masculinity as always being sort of the manifestation?
And I think they have the potential to give permission to each other to exist. Mm-hmm. And I would still also see enough, like, where you can see these, they exist in different places and in different communities. And the extremism or like the severity of that hate, exists in it's like the misogyny that exists in different communities, like whether they're overseas or here, whether it be in different Muslim and Jewish communities. I think that some people would reject that they were the same, but like a lot of their ideologies actually line up pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I think that's some gray space to consider.
Yeah. Yes, your question.
So I have a question about the coalition building. And I want to take the word linkage and think a little bit about proximity.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what I'm, so I also, I'm Aziza is my boss. I'm one of the facilitators on the Muslim Jewish conversations. And I know I've watched these relationships get built. And I see that actually I'm starting to see them change over time, even after people leave the fellowship, and seeing the lasting after effects of doing the really hard work of getting through the really hard conversations about Israel-Palestine and many other things. It is so time intensive. It is so energy intensive. And I really believe, I'm looking at, like, Brenda, you were so generous in your discussion about African Americans and Ashkenazi Jews in this country, right? But there's a lot of pain between the Muslim and Jewish communities, between the African American community and the organized Jewish community. And I'm very worried that we need to create spaces where we can be in good proximity with one another and not distance or bad proximity. My husband grew up in Flatbush, Brooklyn. It was a very integrated neighborhood. They spent all afternoon fighting one another on the street. So that's that bad kind of proximity. How do we get, like, what are your visions for creating constructive proximity that doesn't take so much energy and resources?
Integration, safe space, brave space, the role of a university. What are we doing?
I think that's the thing. It's like, is this a priority? Like, mm-hmm. Is it really a priority? Because if it is, then it's going to take serious investment from all of us.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I'd go back to the point about my response to Jerry's point about linked fate. It's that calibration. I mean, we have to recognize we're different and we have a shared humanity. I mean, it seems to me those are two essential operating principles with which you begin a conversation. We have to recognize that each of us has our own story and tells our own story. And we have to be willing to hear the story of the other as well as take time to explain our story to the other. Something that I've been involved with around Israel-Palestine is the importance of dual or multiple narrative historical accounts. I think history is an important part of the equation as well. Exposing the other to your story and having the others and hearing the other story, understanding that you can fracture that other narrative into many, many narratives, so we shouldn't essentialize it as well. But it seems to me that it's really holding on to that perfect equipoise between difference and identity and treasuring both and recognizing the elements of both in your conversation partner. That's about as good as I thought.
I just want to say that I really like your discussion about the community, although there was fighting all the time, because I think one of the things that we miss is that they're not, I mean, we're at the university, and so in my classrooms we can talk about this, and we can work out some things within the classroom, but my students come from different communities, and they've been socialized their entire lives to feel a certain kind of way, and to see people in a different, in a certain kind of way, with some similarities, some differences, and, you know, and all of that. But I think it's on the community level, it's even on the even familial level at times, that we have to push ourselves to make certain that these conversations take place, to make certain that we present a sense of respect and equality that our children learn from us. Because, I mean, this is generational. It goes generation to generation to generation to generation. And so what's, I think, the hardest thing, why does it fail? Why does we get to a point and it just kind of dissipates? And I think it's because at the end of the day, we grow up in a certain, feeling a certain way about ourselves vis-a-vis other people. That is, we're taught by our parents, in our churches, in our communities, that, okay, this is our group, and these are the good things about us, these are the problems that we have, this is the way to solve the problems, et cetera, exclusion of other people. You know, so I think it's wherever we are, not just in the university, not just in our organizations, that we have to move forward with this kind of presence. For example, when I went to, I'm Catholic, and when I went to Mass the day after the massacre in Pittsburgh, I sat there and I listened to the priest, and you know, we left, and I got into the car with my husband, and I said, I cannot believe this just happened. And my husband looks at me and he says, he didn't even mention it. Mm-hmm. And he didn't. The priest didn't even mention the massacre at all. And we couldn't believe it. And I thought, we just couldn't believe it. I mean, we were just like, how could he not mention it? You know, and so many times things like that happen, you know. And I just feel like, then people feel like, okay, it doesn't touch me. It doesn't have anything to do with me. It's not about me or whatever. And it's just, you know, so it's on an everyday, it's a daily level, it's everywhere we go, you know. When you talked about, for example, the people on the subway, you know, reaching out to, I think at that level we really have to engage ourselves, you know. So anyway, sorry. Josh.
Well, I'll just say two quick things. One would be, and I forget who wrote about this, in light of Pittsburgh, I want to say it was Yair Rosenberg. I want to say, wrote a piece about how comparing what happened in Pittsburgh to Germany in the 30s and Kristallnacht, and recounted the Kristallnacht episode where neighbors, German, non-Jewish German neighbors of German Jews did nothing. Mm-hmm. And he said that when one of the things that's so important to understand, while there's so much that's the same about Pittsburgh, it's part of this long arc, one of the things that's different is that there were neighbors who did something,
right,
and reached out, mm-hmm. and that there were coalitions that formed on the ground immediately. That, and we need to also, it's important to seize those moments, mm-hmm. As well, to see that happening. In terms of like what to do, I mean, one of the places that I go for inspiration a lot is to DJs. I think that like if you look at the way that hip hop DJs make mixtapes, right? To make a good mixtape, which is the world we're living in musically right now, everything we're listening to is a mixtape. It was created through the aesthetics of the mixtape. And I used to try to make them in my bedroom in Cheviot Hills on cassettes with my little Radio Shack mixer growing up here, where the goal is to make a good mixtape, you have to have the song that goes into the next song. Those songs are totally different, and they have to be by different artists, ideally of different genres, or else your mixtape kind of sucks. In order to go from one to the other, you can't just put them together. You actually have to find the one little teeny tiny thing that they each have in common to find that point of connection that allows you to go from here to there and mix without erasing one or the other. And to me, that's been a kind of a manifesto in my head, is how do we mix and be together while preserving difference, not asking difference to melt or erase into one thing, but to actually beat juggle, as DJs say, to keep things alive in the mix without fading them out or in.
Okay, so I realize, just to be clear, we have about 13 minutes, and I will speak not so long. But I know there was a hand over here, so we'll start with Blucher. Yeah.
My name is Justin. I speak Yitzhak. In Arabic, Yitzhak.
I'm an undergraduate student here, Jewish student leader. I'm a descendant of Moroccan Jewish refugees that fled to Israel in 1957. And I think it's very crucial to understand that on campus there is an emanation of anti-Semitism that is not acknowledged. There's a movement where anti-Semitism becomes legitimized, and I think that's through anti-Israelism, or a phenomenon of Zionophobia, something in which people are describing the fear, the resentment of Jews enacting their equal right to self-determination in their historic indigenous homeland. So, and that doesn't have to come at the expense of anyone. Whether or not you want to dispute that, that's a separate conversation, but what I'm here to serve in this conversation is to really ask the panelists, with regards to progressive movements, intellectualized hatred and things like that. I mean, we can see phenomena as clear as Linda Sarsour, Tamika Mallory of the Women's March, legitimizing hatred by dismissing or ignoring or endorsing comments by viral anti-Semite Louis Farrakhan. And then that will get retweeted by David Duke of the KKK. And that really just shows how marginal anti-Semitism is on the political stage, that we think of racism usually coming from one side of the political spectrum, but really on campuses like here, such as through the BDS movement and other things like that, that Jews are really pitted in the middle. We don't have a side to go to. We don't have political people to represent us. Student government, just like SJP and other individuals and groups, they like to strip and void us of solidarity and invalidate us when we are calling out anti-Semitism in its very immediate forms on this campus. So with that, how can we delegitimize those who try to delegitimize our statements, and when we call out anti-Semitism very immediately for young Jews on this campus in progressive movements where we think we have a safe space, but really we're put on the fringes?
So, I want to hear, they're hard questions and also, strong statements, and I thank you for sharing them. Can I just ask a question? I mean, part of it is just to get, in some ways I do work for the administration when people say that somehow any form of prejudice is not taken seriously here. It pains me, concerns me in all kinds of ways. I want to convey very clearly that everyone cares. But I don't think it's that useful necessarily to go back and forth on the empirics about who cares and whether you care enough and all of those things. Here's the question, and I mean this in the most sincere way. One way that I understand issues is by flipping scripts and thinking about it in different ways. If members of, say, the African Student Union, I'm just going to pick that student organization, comes to me and says, look, there's an academic here who's arguing against race-conscious admissions, and he's against affirmative action. And he says he's doing it not because he dislikes African Americans or Latinos or Southeast Asians, but he just thinks it's a bad policy. He also thinks it's unjust against whites. And he keeps on saying that, but we know he's racist. And you've got to admit publicly that he's racist, because you could not actually fight against race-conscious admissions unless you were racist. How do you respond to that kind of claim? Is it possible that he's not racist, or do you think that the strong signal of being against race-conscious admissions must be that 99 out of 100, the guy's racist?
I thank you for posing that question, and I see where you're coming from. I recognize that sincerity. However, I reject the premise of the question because I do think it's a false equivalence.
Uh-huh.
BDS or similar movements are not in place or in the campus environment to dispute just a simple policy, but rather denying Jews the equal right to self-determine at all. That's at the very forefront. It's in the doctrine of the founder, Omar Barghouti, and many individuals. So to separate that fundamental hatred or denial from the movement, whereas you're talking about a specific policy in the United States, is very different things.
So I get it, and again, I don't want to hog up more time, but I mean, you know, part of it is, like, let's just take BDS off. If someone just said, in this context, there ought to be an economic boycott, I've never heard of BDS before, don't know any of the history or the problems, it's just that in this context, I want that policy reform. The only reason why I ask it, and again, I don't mean, again, context is everything. Flipping scripts are really important to actually test ideas, but if you're ignorant of context, then you are creating false equivalencies, and the best scholars, the best thinkers understand the value of flipping scripts, but also understanding why context matters. So I don't mean to suggest that there's an easy answer, but the claim of important, again, suffering,
right, not being given adequate attention on this campus has been put on the table. It's a hard one to discuss, but this is in some ways a moment of honesty and collective intimacy, and if it's ever going to be discussed, I guess we could discuss it here, and again, in the good faith with which we've engaged so far. If people want to have reactions, and there'll be nothing more than reactions in some sense, I would be, I invite them. I know it's really hard, and again, and this is fraught ground, but this is how we show sometimes some courage.
I just want to respond to the young man, because I want you to know that I did hear your question. I don't understand all the details of what you're asking, but certainly if you have a sense of being, of your basic rights being denied you, this is something that, you know, certainly should be heard and taken very seriously at the university, on all levels, that is, from the chancellor and maybe up to the president's office and down downward towards faculty and other students and the student organizations as well as the student newspapers, et cetera. So given that I don't know very much about it, I would suggest to you, and I don't know how your organization works, but that, of course, countering other organizations that you feel are, you know, in some ways denying you or fundamentally denying you your right to exist and your right to express yourself and to have a homeland. Organizing, of course, having speakers to address that, getting spots in the daily newspaper, having rallies, connecting with the larger community. I think these are all things that will at least get people to understand your point of view or to hear your point of view, and having open debate also. It might sound silly to you that I'm saying this to you, but I just wanted you to know that I did stop to think about what you were asking, and these are the kinds of ideas that come to me in response.
I've already laid out what I think of BDS, but I do want to respond and tell you, again, I hear your point and your experience, and it seems very real and very raw, and that has to be heard and honored. I guess what I would say, Justin, it's important to, again, in thinking of this question, to distinguish between, at least for a minute in our thought experiment, between intent and effect. I try to think, you know, with that kind of empathy that I think we all should aspire to understand the other as someone who has spent a lot of his professional and personal life in Israel. I try to think, what might it look like through Palestinian eyes? What does BDS look like through Palestinian eyes? And I think it doesn't take the form of, you know, the kind of anti-Semitic agenda that you'd find in the pages of Der Stürmer or, for that matter, the Daily Stormer. It looks like an agenda, a nonviolent agenda, to achieve a long-deferred political goal, which is Palestinian self-determination. And it's at that point that I think we begin to see the unfortunate zero-sum nature of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which we have to find some way to overcome. But I guess, you know, when I look at it from that perspective, there's an added dimension of humanity that is integrated. I don't assume the intent is anti-Semitic. What you're saying is the effect can be for you. And, you know, I think we have to find ways to talk to one another to make clear what our actual intentions are. Because my very strong sense is that, you know, my own view is neither an intent or effect is BDS anti-Semitic, though there are, I will tell you, there are people associated with the movement, one of whom you mentioned, who will tell you Jews are not a people, which is a deeply disturbing claim made that, to me, verges on anti-Semitic.
He's the founder of the movement.
Correct. He's one of the founders of the movement. I mean, there were, as you probably know, 78 organizations that founded the movement. So I think we can't and shouldn't deny those aspects, but it's also helpful because I happen to know lots of people, or a fair number of people, who support BDS, some of whom are Palestinian, and I don't see them, and I sniff, it's a kind of professional vocation for I don't see anti-Semitism as a present factor in their support of the movement. So I think when you engage in that kind of thought experiment and see the other side, it looks somewhat different. It's not a source of ultimate consolation to you. I understand that. But it's also really important to acknowledge that I have empathy for what you're saying. I just don't agree with your description of BDS. And more importantly, I think it's very different from the kind of hate-filled invective that that motivated Robert Bowers.
I'm on the same page of disagreement simply just because the disproportionate focus of BDS, its movements, its proxies, its daughter organizations, they focus disproportionately on denying Jewish self-determination and don't focus on building Palestinian self-determination when the chance for a state for Palestinians has been offered over 5 times in various opportunities. So my concern is really, how can we address that? Because what you're talking about when you say you can't spot the anti-Semitism in it, despite some people being overtly anti-Semitic in the movement, is that you're intellectualizing the hatred. You're giving it a platform. The former chief rabbi of the UK, Rabbi Sacks, said that the Jewish people were once hated for their religion, then their race. I mean, it still happens today. Now they're hated for their nation state. So to deny that that's an integral part of the BDS movement, that people advocating for BDS aren't adhering to that, whether it's unconscious or conscious hatred, is fundamentally ridiculous. And I think it's ignoring hate at the very site of legitimization.
So I think, so I think we will have to, and I fully respect the fact that we could actually talk without necessarily screaming at each other in all kinds of ways. Now, I feel really bad because we've hit 7 p.m. and I want to respect people's time, and I see other hands. I think some speakers might be willing to stay and continue the conversation. All that I want to say, and again, out of respect for time, because I think people had a good chance to engage with all of their thoughts, is that these moments of contact and conflict that I view as moments of collective intimacy reveal a certain kind of vulnerability where people are willing to actually share what they think, recognizing that when people do share what they think, their fears, their suffering, their hopes, and their limitations, oftentimes bad things happen to us. And, you know, academics do this all the time. We never want to share our vulnerabilities because we were probably picked on when we were in the playground, and we need to show strength through a certain kind of intellectual overperformance. And when I see counterexamples of thoughtful listening, regardless of agreement or disagreement, just thoughtful listening and a mixture, indeed a mixtape of ideas and beats, I feel a little bit more optimistic. It's not by any means a panacea, but all I wanted was one example where we could do a little bit better, and I think this panel is it. For that, I'm deeply grateful. Thank you very much.